This is GamesAtWork.biz with Michael Martin and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with.
This is episode 305, Side Scrolling. Hello and welcome again to another edition of GamesAtWork.biz. This is Michael Martin coming to you live, at least for me, as I record this, from my headquarters location in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host, Mr. Michael Rowe. How are you doing today?
I'm live here at Michael Rowe headquarters.
One Microsoft Michael Rowe way.
Yes, right. I was going to say loop, but that's a real play, so infinite goop? No. I don't know. I am well, Michael. I'm excited that we're going to have some fun on a podcast day and start it off with some really good fun. So why don't we take it away and not talk about the weather?
Yeah, exactly, because weather is weather. So the first thing that's here to play is the 2020game.io. So I love this. Set it up for us, Michael. What is this game and what was your experience? And then I'm going to jump all over it because I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah, so this is a side scroller and it's a run to the right game. The basic 8-bit art designed for running in a browser, and you get to experience all the different trials and tribulations of 2020 from a US perspective. Because there are some stuff that's US specific, and your goal is to make it out alive at the end. And I had a blast. I did. I didn't survive the first four or five times. It took me a while to jump my way through because I wasn't paying attention. But I know you've played it too. So, jump on in.
So I'm playing it right now, and my little character is trying to get past the 5G screen here where it's spewing coronavirus because.
Oh, that's because it does, right? It's 5G does
but
cause.
But luckily, you know, my guy here has got. Oh yeah, now I'm in the TikTok phase. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
We'll just leave that go. What a wonderful little side scroller! And so, yes, longtime listeners will know that I'm a big fan of the 8-bit kind of art style. So that's a great start as a browser game goes. It's funny. It reminds me very much of our friend Ian Bogost, who we've had on the show here at least a couple of times, to talk about how games function as social commentary. And that's exactly what this is. It's making fun of, okay, you got to run through the pre-lockdown phase and collect your canned goods and your toilet paper, and you got to avoid all of the fires in Australia and everything.
And we're not going to talk about the end.
No, we won't, because I didn't get there yet.
I've made it. Oh, you haven't got there yet? Oh, I made it to the end, and it's don't want to spoil it for anybody, but it is, you just have to survive 2020. That's it. Yeah. That's it. That's all you have to do. It's really fun. And what's great about it is, I mean, this was just a pet project from a young developer who's like, hey, I really want to get into game development. You know, click on this link and donate to me, which is cool. You know, I think that's great for them. I thought it was hilarious. I really enjoyed it. I think I saw it originally on Twitter.
So,
yeah. Just floating out there.
The only thing that's missing is a picture of Bernie Sanders sitting in here just watching you as you play.
See, that would be 2021, right?
Still, you know, Bernie, he can time travel.
Yes, he can.
There were some hilarious ones from Mark Hamill's account about the combination of Bernie Sanders and Star Wars.
I saw the Baby Yoda one. That was pretty funny. The other one that I saw that I really liked was the Devil Wears Prada.
I didn't see that one, but I can imagine.
Yeah.
The Devil Wears Mittens.
You're really close. You're really, really close.
we'll have to find a couple of those and drop them in here. If you have a particular favorite Bernie Sanders meme from earlier this week, drop it in, because this was a bipartisan thing, as I saw. A lot of people had fun with it.
Yes, and if you're not in the U.S., you can still enjoy it. Just imagine your great uncle.
Yeah, yeah. Sitting in the background of the cockpit of the Millennium Falcon as you're flying along. Yes. You know,
there was one on one of the women's U.S. national team soccer players who's sitting at the and she's sitting on the bench. You know, it must have been just one of these whole games where you're just totally exhausted. And well, once you understand the meme, it's great.
All right, well, let's move along to some more games, because we're not done with games yet. There's an Ars Technica article that came across my feed this week talking about the Xbox. And again, short-term listeners will know that between Andy, myself, and Michael, we've been talking about Xbox and PS5 and all the platforms and supply chain trouble and problems. This one is a really intriguing one on a lot of levels. And it is, when you think about the power consumption of these devices and sort of that vampire mode of, you know, look around, how many wall warts do you have that are plugged in that aren't, you know, doing something but are still consuming electricity. Well, these boxes are designed to be very fast to power up and get you started playing your games and to save your games too.
Instant on, baby.
Instant on, yeah. So apparently, there's been a calculation, which is probably not that difficult math to do, simple multiplication, will projects that once the supply chain problems are licked, we might have 4 billion, let's do the right word, 4 billion kilowatt hours consumed by 2025 for the instant on feature from Xbox.
But
that is like an enormous amount of energy.
But is that implying that the supply chain issues will be resolved by 2025?
That was my first caveat, Michael. Exactly right. So you caught it. There are capabilities here that I think are even better. And as we're getting more and more towards cloud and cloud-related gaming with local storage, with ways of storing and saving your games locally, the trick here is just going to be getting through the boot-up sequence quicker. Mm-hmm. But there are ways to change this. And if I remember, Europe has actually said that the default procedure should be to not use instant-on, but to cause you to power up when you need it.
Why don't they call instant on what it is? Always on.
Yes.
Or okay. Never right. Off.
Right.
Right? I mean, that's what it is. It's in some low power, quote unquote, state where it is in a ready mode to where you get instant gratification of getting into your game or into the menuing system by pressing one button. But it's always on. Or never off. I really think they should call it never off.
You're right. And actually, let me be careful here. I'm reminded, just looking at the article again, that the PlayStation 5, on the flip side, it has a what they're calling rest mode. And that is a very small level of power consumption.
Again, so never off.
Always awake. Never off. So I thought this was intriguing. Yeah. And then it reminded me, gosh, from days of yore, long time ago, when there was an ability to do the world community grid kinds of functions, to do grid scale computing, to look for solutions to problems like what could be a antivirus vaccine, uh-huh. for example, for something that you could run on these kind of gaming platforms and devices. So my brain kind of leapt to the notion that if you do want never off, as Michael has coined that term here, wouldn't it be nice that you could use that compute power, that spare idle compute power, for something that would benefit the common good?
Yeah, and I actually think that's still going on. That tool is still out there. I remember seeing some colleagues of mine at the office when we went into the office still running that. And I think it's laudable that people were doing it. I was doing it early on with SETI at home. Right.
Yep.
Which then became part of the Boinks client, I think it was, which ended up into the community grid. But the challenge was, it's not just using spare compute cycles. People were then leaving the machines on 24 hours a day. So it was driving more power consumption, which then led into the same mindset of Bitcoin mining. And we know how much power that has consumed for the proof of work algorithms.
That and I think this is a conversation we had on the show earlier too around AI and the power consumption around building AI models too, just being, you know, crazy powerful,
yes,
and crazy power consuming, right?
All-powerful consuming.
So let's move from, you know, games and ones and zeros to something else that comes out of a lab, except this kind of thing is something that you would eat.
Yummy.
Yes. Well, maybe not. So there's a notion here, Michael, from an article you found from MIT about a new method for growing plants.
Yes. And to be honest, I remember finding the article and I never got a chance to read it. This is one of those ones that you go, this is really cool. I'm going to throw it into the show notes and I'm going to read it in time for the show.
Well, the neat thing I saw about it is that there's certainly been large advances made in plant-based meat type products, and the article does talk a little bit about that. This is a little bit different, about focusing on how can you increase the efficiency of agricultural output.
Yes.
And do it in a formed and shaped way. In a very defined space.
Kind of like square watermelons.
Yeah, a little bit like that. A little bit like that. And when I think about what I'd like to do growing-wise this growing season, I don't know if I would use something here from the lab.
No.
But in case you're wondering, buy your seeds early this year, people, because we all know there was a run on seeds last year, a little bit later than this time, when folks were like, I better go and buy some seeds.
Yes. And you know, one of the things to consider with that is, you know, if you are going to try to do a little plot of land that you're going to do some sustainable local farming, don't forget to save your seeds.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, one of the really cool thing about most plants is, I would say all plants, unless they're like lichen, will grow and generate some kind of seed pod. You eat some of them, you save some of them, and then you can make more.
Crunch all you want, we'll make more.
That's right. I promise to read the article before next week's show, and then we can not talk about it next week, please.
Oh, okay, cool. Hey, are there any other articles that I need to be careful about here?
Oh, well, it was funny because, you know, here's some behind-the-scenes stuff. As we go through this and kind of curate the show, and Michael does a lot of work on that, he mentioned lab-grown meat. And I was like, I don't remember a lab-grown meat article. Maybe I only said that in my head and I didn't use my outside voice.
Yeah. Could have been, or it passed over me. Could have been,
but it's fun. So yes, this happens sometimes when you're recording a weekly podcast or a periodically close to weekly podcast. Since really, in all forms and fashion, 2006, realize it's like 14 years of doing this.
We're season. This one, we're on season X, season 10.
That's right. We're on season 10 of this podcast.
But the prior one, which is what you're referring to, is like we've done two.
Yes.
Back to back.
Yes.
All right. So talking about delivering podcasts. there you go.
Yeah, that's a professional segue. You could only do that after years and years of highly disciplined, highly
verbal gymnastics
skills.
All of that. So we started off a little bit on the virus already, and now that we're in the throes of people being vaccinated, and actually I'm really grateful my mom got her shot yesterday.
Excellent.
Actually. So that's pretty darn cool, her first shot anyway. There's been offers for help and support, and this particular article is focusing on what Amazon is doing with their logistics engine and set of capabilities and ground game to say, hey, can we help?
Yeah.
And it's
really interesting. I actually heard a couple other podcasts talk about this, so I'll try not to repeat too much of what they said. Mm-hmm. But the thing that is so incredible about this, we've all, I'll say all in a kind of general perspective, many of us have done same day delivery or next day or 2 day delivery with Amazon. And the only reason that's possible is because they have a distribution network and distribution centers conveniently located in order to pull that off, right? And they know how to move supply between all those sites. And if you're in the US, as an example, I am not aware personally of people who can't at least get two-day delivery. So that means the infrastructure that's in place from a supply chain delivery perspective is vast. Now, what has happened is they've offered to leverage that skill and capability and infrastructure to help in distributing the vaccine. And that's phenomenal. Now, I also heard, and I don't know if it was in this article, that they said, and, you know, if you'd be kind enough to let us vaccinate our employees first.
They do talk about the importance of not so much first responders, but for people that are really on the front lines. Yep. And when you think about it, the delivery infrastructure, there's a lot of prioritization that needs to happen in all of this.
Yep.
And there are ethical considerations across the board. And
yep.
There's a lot of interesting takes. So I see where you're going with that. And that makes sense to me.
I understand it, but it regardless... it can come across as a selfish act, right? And so the optics is where I was going on, because you're right. If you need to have people to work to do the deliveries, right? Maybe it's a subset. It's not the entire infrastructure of everybody who moves packages around a warehouse. So I think the offer is fantastic if it can be leveraged in such a way to drive, you know, the next 100 days and the delivery of all the vaccine. I think that's, you know, you have to say yes to that.
Well, here's kind of what I thought of when I saw this too. I do see the line about the essential workers in the letter that went to the president, suggesting and asking, you know, that we can help, and also saying that there's an agreement to have a licensed third-party occupational health care provider to administer the vaccine on-site at Amazon facilities for the Amazon employees. Mm-hmm. Here's the what if. Because we're not done yet, and it's going to take so long to get what I've been calling, and you'll smile when I tell you this, the farm-to-arm pipeline delivered.
I didn't even smile. I laughed.
Yeah, I like it. I'm glad you did. You know, and if you'd like to license that for me, please let me know.
Is it a pretty inexpensive licensing fee?
I'm sure we can come to an arrangement. So the interesting thing that went through my mind was, it's not just the Amazon distribution network. It is much more along the lines of what you just said, Michael, about getting the vaccine where it needs to be in a quick and timely fashion. So if you couple materials, logistics, and now a delivery mechanism, imagine what if in a world when you could have delivered to you via an Amazon delivery driver a self-administerable vaccine. And you don't need to go to a stadium or to a hospital or to whatever. It arrives to you and you're able to place it on your arm, press a button, and it injects and it's done.
Yep.
You know, could we do that? Why couldn't we do that? You know,
because 1% of the population has reaction to shots, right? That I love that idea, but it, you know, I've gotten my flu shot for 20 years now, somewhere around there, and most of the times, and I know this is the case with the COVID vaccine too, is they ask you to sit in a place
For about
30 minutes, depending on the vaccine, so that a trained medical staff person could be there in case you develop a reaction. So I think in a perfect world, that wouldn't be a problem. In where we are today, I think the
risk-reward balance
of caution
is still,
adverse reactions would say, no, you're still going to have to go somewhere. It won't be delivered to your house.
Yeah, no. So I stand corrected, and you know, you're exactly right. We've survived this far and this long at this point. So that is probably out of the abundance of caution where you'd want to be.
Yeah.
Were we still earlier days as an emergency mechanism, you know, that going through my head, there's so many people that inject themselves already on a day-to-day basis for the things they need to do.
Yeah.
So good point. All right. So let's move from computing in the cloud and service and delivery networks to things that get moved around and ported onto Macs.
Well, not just any Macs.
So we got a couple stories
not
here.
Just not any just Macs. Any. The M1
Mac. So you were amongst the happy few that had an early edition of Apple's silicon.
One of the things that you have an opportunity to do that when Apple has done these platform transitions is usually through the developer program.
Network.
You can request early access to a piece of hardware to allow you to port your code. And I think at this time I'm okay to publicly talk and say I actually had one. It was called the DTK or the Developer Transition Kit. So it was not an M1 Mac. It was a precursor to the M1 Mac. Basically, it had the guts of an iPad, but ran Mac OS, which is it's phenomenal, right? I mean, and you've seen people on websites talk about this in more detail, so I'm only repeating what others have already said. It's phenomenal. And so one of the things, once the M1 was released late last year, was could Windows run on it in boot camp? And the answer was no.
Right.
Could Linux run on it? Well, no, right? There's all these no's. It is a piece of silicone designed to run Apple's operating system, in this case, Mac OS. Well, Torvald Linux, how do you pronounce it? Linus Torvald, that's his name. Thank you.
Linus.
Said, you know, this device just seems like the perfect thing for Linux, right? There's now been a couple of people who have actually ported a version of Ubuntu to run on the M1 Mac. It requires it boots from a USB key, right? Because there's something that has to load because of the way that device is hardware locked down at the I don't want to say microco level, but it's a virtualization platform that they use. But this is the first step. It's really exciting. And from the people that I do know who have like the M1 Air or the M1 Pro, MacBook Pros, it's a phenomenal piece of hardware, phenomenal piece of engineering. And this is the first step for people who are going to buy one, hack it open, and make it available for other operating systems. So I'm really excited to see this.
Very interesting. I'm excited actually about some of the rumors that I've been seeing about the newer hardware that's on various sites too, and the return of MagSafe.
I think that's crap. I think that's crap. I was actually listening to ATP, I think it was last night, or was it?
Yeah.
Or was it one of the other ones? Anyway, one of the really geeky ones that I like to listen to, and they're like, basically, all the current rumors are the entire wish list, the things that everybody wanted for the Mac that Apple didn't do. So now they're the rumors that that's what they're doing next. So MagSafe. Apple gave up MagSafe how many years ago to put USB on there? USB-C? So now Apple's going to go, nah, never mind, we were wrong. Now, that doesn't mean they won't do something different. They're not going to bring back the MagSafe adapter that was on there. Second one, they're going to wipe out the touch bar. Now, Everybody wants them to wipe out. I like the touch bar. Okay,
I know I'm
radical that way, but I like the touch bar. If you use it as it was designed, it's really cool. And in the MacBook Pros, with the escape key, separate escape key, and the separate fingerprint reader key, the touch bar has not been a problem at all for me. I really enjoy it. I don't want to lose it. So I hope they're wrong on that rumor. But it's like, okay, we're gonna bring back all the ports that we got rid of. We're going to put the old plug on that we got rid of.
Happen.
We're going to get rid of the thing that we added that nobody likes, right? It's like everything that I've seen in the rumors, other than it'll be M1X or M2 or whatever the hell they want to call it, it'll be better M, kind of like two Michaels.
MM,
yes.
There's an idea.
Yeah.
Contact us if you'd like to license.
That's right. I'm sure we can come to an arrangement. But the basic idea is, I think there's a lot of wish casting going on right now. And there's probably things in the supply chain that are getting confused. And there may be the Mac Pro Mini, or whatever they call it, the Mini Mac Pro, right? Not MacBook Pro, but Mac Pro, that has all these additional ports. There may be, you know, improvements to certain things. I think what would be really cool is if they would take the Magic Keyboard and add a touch bar to that. Right?
Ooh.
So that you can actually have a touch bar for other devices. I recently actually, and I'm showing this on our video edition of the podcast, I recently picked up a new mouse and keyboard, a Logitech one, because it has a button on it. It's the MX Master Series, and I can have it switch between my iMac, my Windows machine, and another machine through the touch of a button, mouse and keyboard. And so I was able to...
It's a cool KVM kind of thing that's all done wirelessly?
All wirelessly. No wires. I've been able to take, like, two sets of mice and keyboards off my desk, down to one instead of three. I think if that could have a touch bar on it for my Mac environments, that would be heaven.
So what if... instead, because I'm a big fan of the trackpad, the remote trackpad kind of, you know, setup, right? So the Magic, whatever it's called, yes, that.
The Magic trackpad.
Showing on screen. Magic trackpad.
Also shown on our video feed.
On our video feed. What if, instead of that just being a piece of glass that has nothing on it, if it could then have instead a display that you now could select and choose various things from?
Yeah, I think, is it Lenovo or Acer that has that in a laptop? Where they have a laptop with two displays, mm-hmm. with a main display, and then half of the keyboard on the bottom is a display, the top part, that you can tilt up slightly and put other content on.
Wasn't there like a Nokia phone or something that operated like that? So like you would open it, the clamshell up, and then you'd have the screen on top and then some things on the bottom that you could manipulate.
What was it? The Sidekick way back in the day?
Sidekick was really super cool, but that flipped up and gave you a keyboard, which I was in love with that when I first saw that. And, you know, shout out to my friend Joe from high school, because he was the one who showed me that to start with. But no, there was, I think it may have been a Nokia device that you could open it and you would have a screen where you might have a browser and be able to go to websites and such. And then on the bottom, you could now, it would have a variable thing that might be the phone pad for you to choose numbers, or it might be, you know, another way of entering content, or it might be some icons, or I don't know, something like that. I don't remember.
I'll
have to look at that Lenovo one.
I don't know if it was the Flip or something, but the foldable phones have that as a model now, right?
Mm-hmm. So why couldn't that be the trackpad that's on the laptop itself? We've seen ideas that have popped up before that says I can embed or I can dock a phone in there, mm-hmm. which would act in that capacity. So why couldn't you just have a remote one, you know, or the trackpad that's on the laptop do precisely that?
Cool.
And then it would give you context sensitive iconography mm-hmm. to let you do what you needed to do.
Again, just like the touch bar, which is kind of
cool. Just like the touch bar. But closer.
But cooler.
And thinner.
And thinner. and with less battery that lasts longer.
Yeah, exactly. That'd be awesome. We talked at the beginning of the show about side scrolling.
Yes.
Now we're going to talk about side loading.
Oh, yes.
So one of the benefits of these new Macs is that you could put on your Mac, onto macOS, iOS apps. And apparently... the side loading thing is now ipso non grata, not functional.
I haven't tried that yet. So I did side load a couple of apps on the DTK. Mm-hmm. I had the HBO Max app running badly, very badly. I had Overcast, podcast player, was cool.
Like them, yep.
And I tried a couple of other ones. And what was really neat is after you did the first load, the next time you started the app, if there was an update, it updated.
Wow. That's cool.
Yeah. I have not checked to see if I added new apps, if that would work. I do know that HBO Max, I think, said, hey, there's an update, and it wouldn't go get it. So that may have been a start of this code, and this is supposedly it actually makes sense. As a developer, you can choose to allow your app to be deployable on an Apple Silicon device. So if you write an iOS or iPad app, you can. There's a checkbox, and you get. By default, it was on. Now I think it's by default off. But you can go and flip it on your developer portal and say, yeah, make it available. Just make it available.
Right.
So I think it's appropriate. Is as a developer, I decide that my app is not suitable to run in that environment. I shouldn't be forced to allow it. So I'm okay with this.
Okay. Well, I guess that makes sense. But the thing that kind of what I was thinking in my way through this was we're not sideloading something from an external unapproved source. They're all from an official app store. They're the iOS app store. They're the macOS.
Yeah. App store, but what you have to do is you actually have to put a cable into your iPhone or your iPad, run a third party tool that allows you to get around the environment to get to the code. iMazing or something like that is one that I was using. iMazing instead of amazing. Gives you access to the full file system on your iOS device. And then you go down, find the app, and drag it onto the desktop.
So
you're actually going around the containerization of the platform.
Right. And so you don't get the benefit of the sandbox and the security and this could be a malicious element where stuff could get changed on the way in through that cable and other software, right?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. Bingo. Now that makes sense. I didn't know that was the process. I had this amazing, like, you know, this is easy. I'm going to hold my phone up close to the computer and just go
kind of like you do when you do with your HomePod, right? You just walk over and you go bloop and change the music.
Yeah, exactly. Although a lot of times I keep the music because it's fun.
Yeah.
Now, there are people who keep their computers around for a really long time.
Yes.
And some of those people are Commodore 64 people.
Yes.
But this is not keeping a Commodore 64 around for a long time. Apparently, this is a replica. And I have not watched this video, so I can't even begin to fathom, you know, is this a Raspberry Pi in there? Is this, you know, an old iPhone 6? What's the story?
So I am one of those people who was a Commodore 64 fan. I had the Commodore SX64, which was a 20-pound luggable with a built-in 5-inch color monitor and built-in 5.25 floppy drive.
Was that a touchpad color monitor?
Oh, no. Okay. And then I had the massively secondary external 5.25 drive and a 300 baud modem. 300 baud, baby.
You could almost sing that fast.
Yes. And so I really enjoyed my Commodore. It was a fun device. I still have fond memories of certain games on there. Battle Chess was one of them. Or it was a chess game, and you move the pieces, and then they fought.
Oh, yeah. There was a version of that for Windows.
That came out like 15 years after the original game, or maybe even 20 years after the original game. But you know, it was fun. And I even have on one of my machines, I have a C64 emulator. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a whole website that you can download basically ROMs to load C64 software, Commodore 64 software. So my guess, and I haven't had a chance to watch this yet either. It's one of these ones that I do want to watch is it's probably something as simple as a SOC, right? A system on a chip, a single system on a chip that covers everything the Commodore 64 did, including the really cool 8-bit audio, right? Because the Commodore 64 had, I think, three independent voices, which was the really cool thing about it. And I remember you would download things from CompuServe or Q-Link, which was the precursor to Prodigy. Quantum Link, and they would be game demos that really all they were was a music video of 8-bit music and pieces of cool graphics, either from a game or somewhere else. And so I saw this online. I saw it was sold out already on Amazon. the device.
Oh yeah, because it's super small. I'm just looking at
well,
this,
there's
right?
the yeah, and then there's one that I think is built entirely into the joystick. So I just think this is, you know, a great example of some of the cool stuff that people have done for retro gamers and bringing back and reliving some of the fun games of our youth.
Ha. And, you know, I've just kind of been scanning through the video, and there's a couple of buttons on this device, which is kind of funny because it says one of the buttons is run and stop, and the next one is shift and lock.
Yes.
And it's kind of like run, shift, lock, or one run, stop, shift.
Yeah.
So, gosh, where have I heard that phrase before? Yeah. Somewhere.
From here. Run, this is where it came from.
Yeah, yeah. So now I know.
Matter of fact, if you put a disc in the drive, if I remember correctly... you would press that button, it would load the first piece of software on the disk and automatically run it.
Oh. I guess that's handy, right? You don't have to find the EXE
thing. There were no EXEs.
Yeah, well, never had a Commodore 64, so don't even know. I do appreciate the prime numbers that are used for the F buttons,
yes.
though. I think that's pretty cool,
yes.
too.
Yes.
All right, so moving right along, because we are going to run out of time here in just
Imagine
a moment.
That.
This next article, Michael, you found it. Set it up. I've got things I want to set.
Yeah, so this is actually I don't know, would you call it a research project? It's a story from The Verge of a multi-year project that was done to scan in... the famous Vermeer painting, Girl with a Pearl Earring. And you say, well, we've got lots of really good pictures from paintings, so, you know, you can not have to go to the museum. But no, what they did is they spent years using a microscope scanner to scan the details of this famous painting so that you can actually do research on the painting. It goes... to such a fine level of detail, you see the wave of the paint and the cracks in the paint at a level that, you know, yes, my eyesight has been not as good as it used to be, but I don't think I could have seen that stuff when my eyesight was 20/20, right?
You couldn't get close enough to the painting.
Exactly.
To
do it. So this is, it's just phenomenal. And years ago, I supported a Kickstarter called Reboot the Suit. Which was a Smithsonian Kickstarter to actually scan in Neil Armstrong's spacesuit.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And I've got 3D models of, like, the glove. That was one of the perks that they gave away. And it was so that they could create new experiences for people to experience history and art much more up close and personal without having to be there. And in this time of COVID... you know, this is the stuff that just fascinates me. So what they've done with this is 9,100 photographs stitched together of this famous painting, and it's just unbelievable. So what did you think, Michael?
So several things. So the first thing that I did after looking at the article and saw how they zoomed in, like on the earring, I wanted to zoom all the way in as far as it would go on her smile. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the first thing. And the thing that I saw here is just that the glint of the sunlight on her teeth. When you zoomed in all the way, you know, it's just like, oh my goodness, right? You know, that's how that probably was set, right? The light reflecting off her teeth is what Vermeer did to get that brush stroke, and you can actually see the brush stroke and the energy and the flow.
The thing that I find fascinating about it is you can actually see how he did it, right? You know, you can conceptually understand that you take and you put a little a glint of white to cause a reflective surface look on a two-dimensional painting, right?
Yep.
But now, as you say, you got all the way down to the brushstroke level to see what level of skill did it take to actually do that.
This is incredible, and just the right level of it. Almost looks like it's gold, right? She almost looks like she has a gold cap tooth, and you know what? Maybe she did. I don't know, right? It could have been, probably not at the time. I don't know. Not a dentist or a forensic dental scientist,
especially in the 18. Was it 17 or 1800s when this was painted? I can't remember.
Don't remember
because the dentist might be like the barber.
Yeah, well, probably so. So that was my first thing. Second thing, interesting that you mentioned the point about the Smithsonian. Something else I saw this week, I don't have the link for it handy, I may find it for the show notes, we'll see, is how so many museums have taken the opportunity that the pandemic has presented itself or them with to do something special and different. And the virtual experiences that, for example, the Vatican Museum has done are breathtaking. And the ability, I mean, shoot, there's no way, Michael, you or I could ever get close enough to the various ceiling elements in the Sistine Chapel to be able to see them in detail. It's not this close, all right? So guys, don't get super excited. But you can get a whole heck of a lot closer. Yep. You can get a whole heck of a lot closer. All right, so closing things out for today, we've got one other fun thing to hit, and that is Pixar, a new trailer of Pixar. New trailer for Pixar Popcorn with some of the characters that you know well and love them on Disney Plus, huh?
Yeah, and I've always been a fan of the Looney Tunes, which I know is not Pixar and not Disney. I actually remember when I was very young going to the movie theater and seeing a movie short, cartoon short, before a movie.
Yep.
Little short stories using the Pixar characters. I think this is great. I have not had a chance to watch them all yet. I'm really looking forward to them. I've seen, I think, every one of the movies that they reference. Nope, I have not. There's one that I have not seen yet. So there's a couple of things that will be a way to get deeper into something. By the way, did you watch Soul of the City? The new movie Soul?
Nope.
Highly recommend if you have a Disney account.
It does look good.
It's really good. So, fun stuff. This is kind of our Disney pre-movie post-event.
Absolutely. Well, everybody, we will catch you again next time. It is time for us to go.
Go, go, go.
So, have a great week. And zoom in on pictures.
See ya.
Bye.
You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network. And we'd like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at GamesAtWork_biz or at our website at GamesAtWork.biz.